From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 34th installment of our ongoing conversation with Professor Luciana Bone about the history of the USSR. Luciana, I'm so glad to be able to speak with you.
It's my pleasure, Don, as always.
So, looks like we finally get to the question of quote-unquote permanent revolution, what Marx, Trotsky, Lenin, and Stalin had to say about all of it. And it's been a long time coming.
It's been a long time coming, indeed. And I hope we get,
I hope we get there, too.
Okay, so last time we talked about, we were in 1938, and we talked about what it meant to be a Trotskyist in the 1930s and what was Trotsky's attitude toward the coming war and where the Soviet Union would stand. We said that, a Trotsky position in 1938 was that that the Trotskyist should not be with the European democracies because they were imperialist.
Right.
And imperialism was a bigger threat than fascism. Just summarizing.
Right.
But the Trotsky communists should not be with the Soviet Union because Stalinism was fascism. It was a totalitarian dictatorship.
Right.
Stalin was an imperialist lackey. He would ally himself with the imperialist and would promise to destroy the revolutionary parties in the imperialist countries. In other words, Stalin was a lackey of imperialism and a counter-revolutionary.
Yep. You know what's cute about this? Just to interject for a moment. What's cute about this is that Trotsky's argument essentially completely ignores class analysis. It is entirely outside of a class analysis of the situation at the time, because a class analysis showed that the antagonism between fascism and the imperialist countries was not a class antagonism. It may have been in form, but in substance, the bourgeoisie of Germany was fighting for the spoils of the imperial bourgeoisie of Britain, France, etc. And you had bourgeoisie against bourgeoisie. And in the Soviet Union, you had a proletarian government, regardless of Trotsky's characterization of it as otherwise. And
right.
So the antagonisms between the USSR and either the imperialists or the fascists were based in class, and consequently the choice of enemies should be taken from the point of view of the class that is being represented by the Soviet government, which is exactly what happened.
Yes, that's right. Very good clarification. His idea was that the masses in the Soviet Union were ready to rebel, or suggested that.
This is Trotsky. Trotsky, yeah.
Trotsky, yes. He suggested, and I think even stated, that the masses in the Soviet Union were ready to rebel, and the proof of this so-called uprising that was being squelched was Stalin's purges and his use of terror, which was going on. We're talking about from 1934, the assassination of Sergei Kirov in Leningrad. He was the boss of Leningrad, and from 1934 to 1939. So anyway, Trotsky argued that the evidence that the masses of Russians, of Soviets, were ready to rebel were this repression, the so-called terror, this repression that Stalin launched between 1934 and 1938. And he argued that the society, Soviet society, was organically tending toward ejection of the bureaucracy. This is Trotsky. Okay, so what evidence did he have? Well, the purges. So we have to ask whether the purges were
Who were they directed at? I mean, the question is, who were they directed at? Were they directed at the proletariat, or were they directed at someone else?
Right. Well, were the people on trial, or were the leaders?
Exactly.
Or was there a conspiracy against the Soviet government? Now, this is a bit complicated, but so the evidence he offers is, look at the repression Stalin had to apply in order to suppress discontent. The interesting thing here as a deviation before we even get to permanent revolution is that we have to skip to 1956 to the lies that Khrushchev told in his secret speech at the 20th Party Congress. These lies were essentially the framework for the bulk of the myth-making about Stalin and Soviet history by subsequent Western historians in the field. Essentially, Khrushchev propagated the bulk of the fabrications that Trotsky employed to attack Stalin personally, along with a number of new lies that serve his own needs, that is, Khrushchev's own needs. What I'm saying here, I'm taking you from 1938, when Trotsky was saying these things against Stalin, to 1956, which is when Khrushchev served again these myths. We can skip to 1989, 1990, 1991 in the Soviet Union, when Gorbachev and later Yeltsin rehabilitated all those who had been found guilty in the three Moscow trials and in the Tukhachevsky affair. So what am I saying here? That there is a trajectory from Trotsky to present-day Russia of an anti-communist, can I say that?
Yeah, yep.
Of an anti-communist wave, or at least a counter-revolutionary wave. I mean, who has been rehabilitated? All those that Stalin, that in the period of Stalin had been found guilty of conspiracy in the to assassinate Stalin and to overthrow the so-called bureaucracy, the Soviet communist regime. So we all agree that there has been a counter-revolution in Russia, and that, you know, the restoration of capitalism in Russia. So if Trotsky started the lies and Khrushchev memorialized them, celebrated them, and Gorbachev swallowed them, and Yeltsin rehabilitated these things, then isn't it logical to assume that Trotsky himself was a counter-revolutionary, an anti-communist, at least an anti-communist in the sense that it had developed, that communism had developed in Russia?
Well, you know what's acute irony, too? Not even an irony, just another contradiction, a facial contradiction. It's, 1939 that he's has to defend himself about why he appeared before HUAC, the D's Committee, which was you know, the fascist witch hunt committee of the what was to, about to become the primary imperialist power on planet Earth.
Yes.
This is how he fights imperialism at, allied to fascism, is by going down to the D's committee in the U.S., which ends up being, you know, both fascist and imperialist, in essence, by 1950.
Yeah, that's right. So the interesting thing, too, is to reflect that since 1956, Soviet society was subjected to anti-Stalinist education. Just to give an example, Stalingrad name was changed to Volgograd, but Khrushchev's secret speech was textual material for students to learn. So we have from 1956 to 1989, we have a revisionary type of education in the Soviet Union, which holds that Stalin was not true communism, that he was this paranoid dictator. That nobody, you know, I mean, the fact that there was 30 years between 56 and 1990, or whatever years there was,
yeah.
of a kind of a revisionist education that prepared for the eventual overthrow of the Communist Party,
right.
which was had always been Trotsky's objective.
Yeah, exactly. And on exactly that argument, that, you know, it was bureaucratized, that the bureaucracy was a new caste, quote unquote. You know, mm-hmm. you had people like Dzhilas and others that, you know, spit out that same thing, all contemporaneous with Khrushchev, for example. Tito, you heard some of it there too, you know, even from the official side, in other words. And, you know, what you're saying in essence is that beginning with the secret speech, as that became integrated into the historical, you know, this is part of the history narrative, the official history narrative.
Yeah, the canonical anti-communist history, yes.
This is the actual history being taught to our children. It's Trotsky.
Yeah.
That's what you're saying.
This is why we're talking about this. This is why this is so important. And I have to point out another thing, that I checked Russiapedia, from Russia Today. I don't know if, written by Russia Today writer. The entry on Khrushchev's, on Stalin's terror. The entry just this morning, and I'll quote some of it, which also parentheses. Strikes me as an irony, because if the if RT is state media, as the West says, well, at least this little bit, this account, Russiapedia, this account of Stalin's rule, is anti-communist. And it just makes me laugh that the current Russophobia, I don't think it's a nervous disease, I think it's got economic interests behind it. The current Russophobia by the Americans against Russia is, they don't care
what the actual nature of Russia is. It has nothing to do with the true nature of the society there, of the political economy there, of
that's
the
right,
state there,
right.
Nothing. They don't care what it really is. All they
In the Cold War, they were against communism. Now communism officially, at least for the Russia Today part, communism is been discredited. At least Stalin communism has been discredited, and they still hit on Russia.
Well, look, I mean, I don't know how better to sum it up than this. You can go to images.google.com. There are, or were, at various marches from the November election in 2016 until last weekend, people carrying Trump signs with a hammer and sickle as some of the letters in the, okay, and what that's supposed to impute God knows, a billionaire communist, okay, that's like a Nazi fantasy, really. Then that was it, right? You know,
the
Bolshevik Revolution was, you know, was a plot of Jewish bankers. That was the, you know, one of the Nazi, you know, telltales, which is around again. The same, though, is, or they're just conflating Russia and Hammer and Sickle, which I don't know if they've noticed, but the flag deliberately doesn't have that anymore.
That's right. That's right. And I'll just read you, for the readers, they can go to Russiapedia and under purges and find it. So they say, Russiapedia, Stalin's purges could otherwise be translated as Stalin terror. They grew from his paranoia, is it the psychological interpretation?
Gotcha, right, yeah, right.
They grew from his paranoia and his desire to be absolute autocrat, and were enforced via this terror, were enforced via the NKVD, the Communist Secret Police, and public trials. So that they helped develop a centrally enforced cult of Stalin worship, that's Khrushchev's speech,
right,
and a terrifying system of labor camps, the Gulag. And then the Soviet, they claim, Russiapedia claims, the Soviet heavy industry was weak and in the decline, obviously lacking the capacity to produce enough metal and heavy machinery for the imminent war. So, tightening the screws and exploiting thousands of Gulag prisoners at construction sites and at plants became a part of his sinister industrialization scheme. Now, look at what has been said. This is written now, you know, in our time.
Or it's held out now anyway.
Trotsky had fantasies of the future and said, you know, the economy is weak, etc. But this is looking back and knowing that that industrialization was key to beating the Nazis. And they say this.
Yep. You know, there's some interesting, these things echo so much history, too, not just, you know, presenting it, but also echoing it. You had the apparent, I mean, there was a real one under it, but the break, the apparent schism between the Soviet Union and China, I think over the question of Stalin, really.
Yeah.
And now you have different presentations of the legacy states to, you know, to those that were, you know, in existence at that time. The Chinese state has continued, although there have been some major changes in the post-Mao period and some other adjustments for certain, to characterize at least that. They are different entities. There's no question, people might question the nature of China, but it is certainly the form is it's still a communist nation. The government is a communist government. The government is the Communist Party of China, in essence, at the levers of power, and that is not the case in Russia.
That's right, and they're still and the cap you know the capitalist West is still going after it. So
so
you know we have to realize that there are other motives there, but
right.
To continue, the Russia Today article argues that Stalin's apparatus of terror relied mostly on the NKVD, and Stalin's first purges date back to the 1930-33 and were aimed at extermination of those who opposed industrialization and the kulaks. Now, we've gone over the history of who were the kulaks and what the law was regarding those who opposed. And it was an extermination. First of all, the term extermination is incorrect in relation to the kulaks because either they died in fights, you know, I mean, there was a civil a civil situation, a civil war situation, and they were sent to Siberia. We went over this. And so I just wanted to emphasize the fact that from the beginning, from 1917 on, there was in the Soviet Union a silent, more or less silent, sometimes active, but anyway, there was a opposition between how to construct socialism. It goes back to Lenin's position, later Stalin's position, and the position of Bukharin and others who wanted a different way of going towards on the road to socialism. Basically, you have revolutionary versus social democrats.
Yep.
Really, these are the two splits that continued to challenge the evolution of socialism in the Soviet Union. And Stalin firmly believed, now we come to permanent revolution, Stalin's solution, as we know, was to find funds to arm the Red Army, to provide for the Red Army, because war would come. Lenin told him it would come. They had gained a little time, but just a little time. So the army had to be provisioned for. Where would the money come? It would come from agriculture, which was the wealth of Russia, which would finance industrialization, which would finance the army. It was the choice that socialism in one country could be the goal to preserve socialism in Russia, in the Soviet Union. Did you want to elucidate on that?
No, that's because it's almost by definition that, and it's interesting that this is another target of the quote unquote ideological trend of Trotskyism, the whole idea of socialism in one country. First, is misrepresented, for what it actually meant, and
yeah.
Second, as itself like an intrinsic affront to the idea of socialism, which is transnational, universal, etc., and you can't have socialism if I don't have it. Which mm-hmm. ignores the way everything happens in nature. You look at bacteria colony infection on a map, or you look at urban development on a map, or you look at the construction of a factory on the existing infrastructure, for the first tier of industrial development. All these different things happen because certain steps were taken that created the preconditions to make them possible.
Yes.
Maybe they make them inevitable, but if they don't make them possible, then the thing doesn't happen.
Yeah, that's right. So the conflict, the political, ideological conflict, was between Trotsky's idea of permanent revolution
right.
and Stalin's idea of socialism in one country.
Right.
And so when... So for him, in 1938, the answer to the coming war was world revolution, through permanent revolution. And he said, timely revolutionary action by the international proletariat could paralyze the imperialists. In other words, an uprising across the world by the proletariat would prevent war. But he said, we must look at the truth straight in the face. He said, the working masses of Europe, in their overwhelming majority, are under the leadership, that is, the tyranny of the Third International, that is, Stalin in Moscow, and they fully support the policy of the Third International and enter together with them into the so-called People's Front. So this now we have to define what he meant by permanent revolution, which in his view, when he stood against the socialism in one country. Socialism in one country led to autocracy, fascism in the Soviet Union. Socialism in one country, Stalin's implementation, it was in Trotsky's view, if he held it honestly, was the opposite of what communism should be, which should spread communism all over the world.
Right.
So he was opposed to the people's, to the Popular Front, which, as we know, was a policy determined in 1935 in the Congress that all social forces on the left would unite against fascism. But the point is, what did Marx say?
Well, before we go to Marx, let me just draw one more quick little picture here.
Yep.
What you're talking about is Trotsky saying that you cannot have socialism in one country until you have socialism everywhere because of the revolution, and that the revolution continues until that happens. And what he's saying is that that's not what Stalin or Lenin or Marx were saying, or in various mixtures of those. And what he's saying, though, is until we can establish socialism everywhere, don't you dare try to establish socialism in one country, because it's impossible, and consequently you're really building something else, which he made akin to fascism. But that's like saying to someone building a house, do not build the foundation until you're ready to put the roof on and the windows in and the hardware and the fixtures in the bathroom all at once. It's absurd. When you're going to change the economic and political and cultural systems of humanity across the globe, to say that you can't start here and then move it from one spot to another is an absurd understanding, or it just shows a complete lack of understanding of the material world in general.
Yeah, precisely. He didn't even take into consideration the fact that industrialization proceeds at different pace and is different,
right.
Takes the world is not all industrialized. You don't have proletariat.
Right. There's no industrial proletariat under the coconut trees.
Yeah, that's right. I mean,
who needs
a colony gets to be undeveloped, for example.
That's right.
You have a very in China. You have a tiny element of actual proletarian. Stalin explains. He says, first of all, Marx did not propose to begin the revolution. So Marx made the statement of a permanent revolution in 1850. So this is the young Marx, and he and Engels have just published in 1848 the Communist Manifesto. But Marx did not at all propose to begin the revolution in the Germany of the 50s with the immediate establishment of proletarian power, contrary to the plans of our Russian permanentists. He did not propose to begin the revolution in the Germany of the 50s with the immediate establishment of proletarian power.
Right.
And Marx proposed only that the revolution be crowned with the establishment of proletarian state power by hurling step by step one section of the bourgeoisie after another from the heights of power in order, after the attainment of power by the proletariat, to kindle the fire of revolution in every country.
And that's where we're going to have to leave it. Right,
Lenin taught and carried out in the course of our blah, blah.
Luciano, thank you very much. We'll finish this topic next week.
Okay, very good.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And that's all the news we have for you right now.
For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.